This is Mary Todd Lincoln. President Lincoln said that you could fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time. But he always said that you can never fool Professor Buzzkill, so don't even try. Let's join the good professor as he talks history, busts myths, and takes names. I'm getting a little hot and bothered just thinking about it.
20th century automobile travel was supposed to represent freedom. But what else did it represent? In a minute, Professor Cotton Siler joins us to discuss the difficulties and hazards faced by African-American motorists in the 20th century while traveling in the United States, especially during the height of segregation and Jim Crow. Specifically, in this episode, we're going to talk about how important guides like the Negro Motorist Green Book and the popular travel guide, Vacation and Recreation Without Humiliation, were to the reality of traveling while black. And now, over to Professor Siler. Yes, here we are with Professor Cotton Siler, as promised. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Glad to be here.
Professor, what were these green books and travel guides that became such an important aspect of traveling while black in the United States?
Well, quite simply, they were guidebooks for African-American travelers in the era of Jim Crow. And they were resources. And in some ways, they picked up on an oral tradition, black travelers telling each other where you can stop, where you can get gas, where you can get your car fixed, where you can get a hotel room, where you can get a good meal without having to go around to the back. In other words, basically, where you could find establishments that wouldn't discriminate. And prior to the Green Books, a lot of this information was really just word of mouth.
So it must not have, word of mouth must not have spread very far. You couldn't have learned about California if you lived in Chicago, for instance.
That's right. But during a lot of the migrations of, you know, in the early 20th century and then around the time of the Second World War, those word of mouth networks extended. And especially if you were, say, a person from Tennessee who wanted to go out to California, that's a long distance across, well, for African Americans, relatively hostile territory, and or at least potentially so. Mm-hmm. And so you might have a cousin who has a friend in Tulsa that had an extra bed you could stay in, or a place where you could find a meal or a rooming house. You know, where you could even find things like a lawyer if you got into trouble.
Oh, right.
So these were informal networks, mostly communicated orally, that then in really beginning in the 1930s, some entrepreneurs began to publish it, began to seek out from people sort of testimonials and recommendations of places where they've stayed, where they've eaten, and began to actually publish this stuff. So it became more standardized. And for the businesses themselves, it was a good deal because you potentially had a lot more travelers coming your way.
Yeah, but it seems that the discrimination and the sort of having to have, you know, separate guides or a guide for African Americans sort of goes against the freedom and excitement of car travel for the kind of average person in the United States after the war. Anyway, it seems that you know, there's a lot of glory about the open road and things like that for white people. It turns out for white people, but not for African Americans.
Absolutely.
Is that what is a stark contrast? Is always amazing to me. First of all, how big it was and how long it lasted.
Yeah. When I first started doing this research, I came to this, you know, thinking about the interstate highway system and our commitment to automobility, mm-hmm. and more generally how mobility is built in to the American myth that we're a nation that's ever in motion, and that one of the marks of our freedom is the fact that we can go wherever we want. Mm-hmm. And if we think about how the car facilitated that and expanded it exponentially,
yeah,
the question then becomes, was that really the case for everybody? And of course, what you see is it's not. That the mobility that we prize so highly is a resource. And it's a resource that's not really equally distributed across the American population. Precisely because mobility is the mark of a free person, there were restrictions on the mobility of people of color, especially, under slavery. Obviously, that's the most egregious restriction of mobility there is. But after slavery, restrictions on where people of color could go, where they could live, when they could travel, all of these things that really we don't really think about as being part of the American, you know, big mythos of freedom and mobility.
And one of the things you mentioned in your book is that because of this, African Americans, when they had to travel far or wanted to travel far, often felt a sense of dread. And I really picked up on that word because it's so strong. And I can't imagine, you know, driving down to Florida and wanting to go visit Florida and the beaches and all, but also having this sense of dread.
Yeah, no, it's really true that what we think of as sort of the open road and the going out to explore America and to find oneself and to be free on the road, that's a very white enterprise. And it's a very white experience. And I mean, it's funny you should say that, especially if you had to drive through the deep South to get to a place like Florida. You could, if you were an African-American driver, you were going through towns and cities where, you know, bad things could happen to you, not just embarrassing things, but we're talking also this is not exactly the heyday, more the tail end, but lynching was still a widespread phenomenon.
Yes, I know, it's terrible.
Lynching was, you know, somebody could be lynched for a multitude of reasons, but one might just be being an African-American person with a nice car.
Yeah, and I mean, imagine traveling with your family or things like that might not have made any difference to lynchers, to the KKK.
It was scary. And so to have this resource, to at least have these little sanctuary points along the way of what might otherwise be a very menacing journey, really, really important.
And so who actually started the guides? Did a company start them, or did a person start them? Or?
It was an entrepreneur from New York named Victor Green. Mm-hmm. And he started the first one, which was called the Negro Motorist Green Book. And Green clearly named it after himself, but he also, the term Green Book was a play on the American Automobile Association's Blue Book,
which
in many ways was a precursor of a road atlas. Uh-huh. It was basically before you had standardized road maps, you had these sort of road guides put out by the American Automobile Association, and mm-hmm. it was called the Blue Book. And it ran, I think it probably went out of business in the late 1920s. And Victor Green picked up on this idea, and he said, well, this is certainly a resource that drivers of color could use. And so he began to solicit testimonials and recommendations from a network of people around the country. Green himself was a travel agent, and I think he was also a postal carrier. So I had a pretty broad network of people, and he knew about you know, destinations, and probably had a pretty good sense of if his African-American clients wanted to go on vacation, where would be the best places to do that. And at the time, there were also, under Jim Crow, there were African-American destination vacation sites.
Entire sites.
Yeah. Yeah. Little beach communities and things like that. That, you know, he would cater to. And so he knew a lot already, but he would actually pay people. I think it was sort of, a dollar, maybe by the 1940s, up to $5 for testimonials that would eventually go into the Green Book. And that was the way that he sort of was able to get the best information. And, you know, I guess he'd have to edit it if a traveler wrote to him and said that place is now not what it used to be, or something like that. But yeah, basically it was taking that oral tradition and putting it down on paper. And
were states, was it just the South that was covered, or was it the entire country, or was it, you know, spotty in the North, mainly in the South?
It was the entire country. I think I think that was the ambition at first. And, the early ones are more sort of East Coast heavy and South heavy. But eventually Green's, the Negro Motorist Green Book, and then other travel guides extended to the entire country.
Wow.
And are just, they're such interesting documents because of both what they are, but also the way in which they describe themselves and they describe their aims.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and they both said very explicitly, we want to put ourselves out of business. So we look forward to the day when this enterprise is no longer needed, which is remarkable. I mean, that's,
yeah, that's right.
But they'd say, you know, until the day when all travelers can move around the country with freedom, this guide is necessary.
Yeah. When I was reading both an article you wrote about this, but also looking at some of the green books that are available online to the New York Public Library and places like that, I noticed that they use a lot of euphemisms for, you know, racial discrimination or racial harassment or things like that. And they would say, avoid embarrassment.
Yeah.
Travel with recreation without humiliation. They're euphemisms, but they sound so loaded.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, it's interesting because these guidebooks, they also want to encourage travel.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They actually don't mention very much. It's bracketed, but mention danger. And so embarrassment and humiliation, which are bad enough. are the ways in which they sort of say, if you use this guide, you will avoid those situations where you might be called racial epithets, you might be refused service, you might be put in jail by some small town sheriff or something like that. But yeah, I mean, and if you also think about their readership, they address a very middle-class clientele, for whom that type of embarrassment or humiliation, you know, would just absolutely strip away any sort of class privilege that they had. And once again, make their racial identity bring it to the forefront. And so if you were a nicely dressed, American couple or family traveling somewhere in the South, and you went into a nice restaurant or a nice hotel and to be refused service. I mean, imagine just the humiliation of that experience. So these guidebooks were sort of, we don't want this to happen to you. We know you're a traveler. We know that you have the money to travel. And, you really need this guidebook to avoid embarrassment.
Yeah, that was also, I thought, a significant thing that, you know, especially after the war, there were enough African-American people of middle class who could afford a car, could afford to take the time off work to travel, could afford to literally travel. And so that must have not only increased sales, but in all these, if you will, hotspots, must have increased the kind of problems that they ran into.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, these guidebooks, definitely, they address that audience, and you see it in the covers, you see it in the rhetoric, the editorial copy. But it's important to remember too that the travelers who either were the precursors, who supplied a lot of the information that eventually made it into the guidebook, or were the precursors of these types of travelers, were professional travelers, were athletes and
sales who were
sort of gathering this intelligence as a sort of pioneers of driving while black. And so, in fact, you know, you think about Negro Leagues baseball teams and where they could stay as they were traveling around the country. And musicians were another constituency there. In fact, the founder of what I think is, I mean, the Green Book is fascinating, but the publication called Travel Guide, Vacation and Recreation Without Humiliation, is in many ways more fascinating. And it's begun by a band leader named Billy Butler. And Billy Butler spends a lot of his time traveling with jazz bands along the African American musical and theatrical circuit around the South. And there's a great story about how this was when he was eulogized at his funeral. Someone told a story about Billy Butler and some other musicians going into a small town restaurant in Alabama or Mississippi or something and being refused service. And they went back to the wardrobe unit of the traveling show they were in, and they got on capes and a headdress and things like that, turbans, and went back to the restaurant and was served as foreign dignitaries or traveling, you know, exotic visitors from wherever. And got this idea that, I need to, you know, it's probably a good business enterprise to start a periodical like this.
Do we know how they rated the hotels and restaurants? Was it like 4 stars or 5 stars, or is it just, you know, don't go here, just either or, this is racist or this is not racist, or this is okay, this is not okay?
Yeah,
there I don't sort of levels of, you know.
Yeah, it wasn't like the Michelin Guide or the Duncan Hines periodicals. It was really, as I understand it, it was kind of just the facts. Here's where this is. Here's maybe what they serve. Here's the name of the attorney. I don't think there's not a lot of commentary in the listings themselves. There are advertisements that sort of specify what type of business or what you can expect there. But the listings themselves were really pretty bare bones and factual.
Right. Do we know, like, if there was a reaction from white people, from business owners, hotel owners, restaurant owners about, you know, we're in the Green Book, or, you know, they were upset about not being in the Green Book or being rated poorly in the Green Book, told people to stay away?
That's a really interesting question, because there's very little in the archive about that. Certainly the strategy of the Green Book and of Travel Guide was to make it known to white businesses the type of trade that they were losing.
Yeah, yeah.
By discriminating, by being a Jim Crow establishment. Here were these well-heeled, certainly financially solvent, sophisticated African-American travelers, and your business was losing out if you were going to turn this trade away.
Yeah.
So there's certainly, and Travel Guide a couple times, and I think Green Book too, makes that appeal. The only instance that I found in my research of a business that, and I may be making an assumption that it's a white business, but it was a letter from somebody from Dickinson, North Dakota.
Right.
And they said something along the lines of we encourage black travelers to visit North Dakota. We have great facilities here, and North Dakotans really want to get to know a part of our population that we don't know. So right, it's very kind of, I mean, in an era of Jim Crow and so much racial hatred, to hear somebody from North Dakota saying, "Come on out to North Dakota, you know, yeah, you'll be welcomed here," is it was kind of uplifting to find that. But that's the only time I saw a white business owner. I should say this is a hotel owner that wrote this.
Yeah.
And there were some businesses that Travel Guide profiled. Skenley Liquor, there was a TV manufacturer that clearly wanted to represent itself as racially progressive in order to attract African American customers.
This is probably a good time for us to take a little break. We've got to go get a sponsorship break from our network. So we'll be back in a couple of minutes. All right, we're back with Professor Seiler. Professor, how long did the Travel Guide and the Green Book last?
They lasted as African-American directed businesses. Uh-huh. They lasted until the late 1950s.
Oh, okay.
The Green Book would, I think it would drop the Negro from its name and become a more generalized guide until 1964 or so. And it's really interesting to me that it's the late 50s and early 60s that they begin to, they just don't have the same purchase. And one of the things that we see is that in the era of civil rights and desegregation, a lot of these African-American businesses, they close up shop. And part of that is good news because, of course, there's integration.
Yeah.
But part of it is really a loss of these really vibrant businesses. Or you think about something like the Negro Leagues, which was...
Baseball, yeah.
Yeah, had its own style of play and was incredibly vibrant and was a real going concern. Mm-hmm. But for the travel guides, I argue that what killed them was the interstate highway system.
Oh, I see. And so people could go long distances without stopping.
Yeah.
Or not stopping much.
Yeah. So that's one element of it. The fact that these were limited access highways where you didn't have to pass through the small towns anymore.
Right. Instead, you couldn't see that you're in the car and yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And you could also go at high speed.
Uh-huh.
High speed rendered you kind of anonymous. It was more difficult to sort of discern somebody's racial or gender identity to when you're going pretty fast and you're being sort of anonymized by that speed. So that's part of it, that you were going fast. You didn't have to stop in these small towns. The limited access highways just passed right through or over them, actually.
Yeah.
And when you did get off, the places where you ate and got gas and got a room for the night tended to be these standardized national chains increasingly.
Oh, so Holiday Inns and things like that.
Exactly.
Eventually. Right.
And what that meant was that if you were discriminated against by some mom and pop diner, you didn't have much recourse. Who were you going to talk to? What pressure were you going to bring to bear on an enterprise like that? That, you know, they'll say, "We don't need your business." But if McDonald's or Holiday Inn or Chevron discriminates against you, the boycott pressure that
an organization like the NAACP or other local organizations, civil rights organizations, could bring to bear on this big national chain, well, that was something.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. And it was done sometimes.
Yeah. And so the interesting thing is that the interstate highway system, which in American cities destroyed so many African-American communities.
Yeah.
Miami, Detroit, New Orleans, Baltimore. I mean, all over the country, you had this, you know, this, they called it, you know, white man's road through a black man's home. The interstate destroyed so many communities. But the flip side of that was that when drivers of color were on the interstate, they had a freedom of movement that they had not been able to experience before. Now, it wasn't just the roads. It was the roads in conjunction with activism and legislation.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. Did the, even though there was a lot more, there was a lot of movement in the civil rights activism, people coming down from the north, people going places to protest. When they, if they found something that would have been in the Green Book negatively, they would have protested against it directly and openly.
Yeah, there, although there wasn't negative stuff in the, there were no listings of you know, bad or discriminatory businesses in the Green Book.
Oh, okay.
They would, you know, they just wouldn't mention a place. But, you know, later on, this one, it was a tremendous public relations gaffe of international proportions when in 1957, in suburban D.C., a man of African descent was refused service at a Howard Johnson. And it turned out he was the finance minister of the new nation of Ghana. So, and of course, this is during the Cold War when the United States is really appealing to people of color around the world. You know, come over to our side. We're the land of the free. We're, and the Soviet Union is just hammering the United States with propaganda, accusing the United States of racial discrimination, and the propaganda is real. Something like that is a real demerit for the United States to have that, to have something like that happen. So there's also pressure from the federal government, and I'm borrowing here from recent history of the civil rights movement that really thinks about the way in which the state was not exactly a driver of civil rights change, but was very accommodating to civil rights change because it dovetailed with its needs to present, you know, sort of a just and sympathetic face abroad.
The state, you mean the national government, not the state governments and
exactly
individual state governments.
That's right.
When do things, can we put a rough date on or rough year on when things start to improve? Is it 1960? Is it 1965? Is it as late as 1970?
Yeah, I think it's, I would say it's the mid to late 60s. And it's also because there's all sorts of, the various Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act. And also you have all sorts of legislation just making it really much harder to discriminate.
Yeah.
In various commercial enterprises, public and private. Mm-hmm. And so there's much more legal pressure that can be brought to bear with these, with this new legislation that, you know, discrimination becomes, you know, in things like housing and that move towards anti-discrimination law is going to affect travelers on the road. So yeah, it's the mid to late 60s.
Has anything ever sort of regressed? Does there need to be a period in the 70s or the 80s or 90s even when somebody has to stand up and say, look, don't visit this town or watch out for this place because of, you know, racial abuse?
So in the middle of the 1960s, people of color driving automobiles becomes in many ways a catalyst for a backlash by police or fear on the part of white citizens. And if you think about a place like Los Angeles in the middle of the 1960s, one of the first, you know, major conflagrations happens because a police officer pulls over a man and a pregnant woman, and this escalates and eventually leads to rioting. And so one of the things that we really have to think about in the United States is what it means for somebody to be in the driver's seat.
Oh, okay.
It means a certain amount of agency and power, but it also means that you're sort of immediately under surveillance and potentially under some sort of action by the government. And so it's always both an empowering place or an empowered place, but also really precarious.
Yeah.
And what we see is over the past few decades since the rise and then demise of these African-American travel guides is that driving a car is still can be a very very fraught thing for people of color, precisely because it subjects you to that surveillance by police, and because it signifies a certain amount of freedom.
Right.
So yeah, we've seen this time and again. I mean, all the recent deaths of somebody like Philando Castile, Sandra Bland, and Philando Castile in Minnesota, Sandra Bland in Texas, and in Missouri over the past few years, there have been a number of incidents that have involved violence against African-American drivers by police that prompted the national chapter of the NAACP to issue a travel advisory about Missouri in the summer of last year.
Oh, wow.
So
that recent.
Yeah, it's still very much with us. The phenomenon of driving while black and the way that can be a very threatening thing. It's still very much with us.
So, I mean, your book is entitled The Republic of Drivers, and it's about the transformation in the 20th century, but really there are these transformations and there are a lot of things going on. It's not as if all of a sudden after the Model T and after World War II, eventually everyone is out there motoring, enjoying themselves. It must be this separate sort of issue, not separate, but parallel experience for people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that happens over the course of the 20th century is that driving becomes synonymous with freedom, and it also becomes compulsory.
Yes, that's right. You have to have a driver's license for everything, not just
you have
drivers.
To have a driver's license for everything. And for, I would say, most of the workforce, people are still driving to work,
driving
to the store, driving to the mall, driving, kids to school. We live in, one of the terms I use in the book is, We've built landscapes of compulsory automobility.
Yes, absolutely.
It's not about freedom anymore. It's about, okay, we have to do this.
Tied to the car, yeah.
That's right. So if you can join that with, there are various groups in American society that don't have this same access to these performances of freedom. And, then what do? If we build these landscapes where you have to have a car, who do we leave out? And also, what does that say about us? And my sense is what it says about us is that we're committed to thinking ourselves free. And that's sort of who we are as Americans. Mm-hmm. And one of the really interesting things, though, is now I'm seeing how we're coming to a close of the era of automobility.
Oh, really?
I'm convinced of it, that it doesn't, for a long time, it hasn't provided the type of satisfactions that it's supposed to provide, which is freedom and escape and autonomy and mastery and agency and all these things.
Upward
now
mobility.
It's basically, we're sitting in traffic. We're, you know, even in the suburbs, which are now some of the most traffic ridden places in the country, they were supposed to be places where you got away from the crush of the crowd and of traffic. It's not like that anymore.
No, not at all.
And also, there's no political will to transform our transport infrastructure.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
When the interstate highway system was built, it was more or less unanimous that this is something we need to do for this thing called the public.
Yeah.
And there's no sense of the public anymore, and there's certainly nobody who wants to invest in infrastructure. I mean, nobody really. Yeah. They might say they do, but they don't really.
Yeah, you can't get very far claiming that you want to have that you want to build, spend money on public transportation.
That's right. Or even to sort of, you know, rethink and reorganize how we move around, which if you go to, you know, Europe or goodness knows China, which is building its own system of automobility right now that's going to dwarf ours, but they're also building high-speed trains and all sorts of mass transit that is really kind of, I mean, our transport infrastructure in this country is shameful.
Yeah, absolutely.
And even if you're sort of a rah-rah, you know, number one USA, we are really falling behind in a pretty, as someone would say, it's very sad.
Yeah, that's true.
That this is happening. But I also see that one of the things that's taken the place of automobility is the internet, which used to be called the information superhighway.
That's right. Yeah,
that's a place where I see it in my students that they'd much rather be virtually mobile than actually mobile. Very few of my students care anymore about a car. A car is, if it's anything to them, it's kind of an encumbrance.
Oh,
and an expense.
That's interesting.
And they'd much rather, you know, if I need a car, I'll rent one or I'll use Zipcar or something like that. But in terms of the way that, you know, I'm 50 years old, so I think about when I was getting my driver's license, that was freedom.
Oh yeah, and that's absolutely the marker of freedom.
Yeah, and it was a way I could go see my friends. I'm not stuck. I can be mobile. But people are mobile on their devices now. They can be literally ubiquitous, and you don't have to actually have your body there. So I see all sorts of changes happening now, and I think it's terrifying the automakers because new car sales are way, way down. And we're obviously going to have cars, you know, whether they're autonomous cars, but that's another thing that, well, who's going to pay for that transition to the infrastructure that autonomous vehicles will require? Well, nobody's stepping up to do that. Google's not going to do it, and the manufacturers aren't going to do it.
Google cars.
Yeah. I mean, so I see this era of automobility is coming to a close, and it's very difficult to see what's going to replace it in terms of a sort of mass phenomenon in the way that automobility has been.
Well, the history of what's going to replace it and how it's going to be replaced will be the subject of your next book.
Moving on to other things, but okay. This is for, I look forward to other scholars exploring this. I'm obviously fascinated by it.
On that note, I should say to our listeners that your book, Republic of Drivers, is on the Buzzkill bookshelf and they can get it there. And it's all been very fascinating. It just remains for me to thank you, Professor. It's been a wonderful episode, and we're bound to get lots of good comments on it.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll say to the Buzzkillers out there that we'll talk to you next week.